Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Welcome back to Critical Mash, a place where critics get together with writers and others to delve into cultural history and the secret connections between films and books and music and art. Today is the one we've all been waiting for. James Bond has been brightening up and blowing up and saving the world for over 70 years now. And now he's back in the news with Amazon taking over creative control of the entire film franchise. Ian Fleming's novels and stories are still among the biggest selling books of all time, up there with The Bible, Harry Potter, Noddy, and Peter Rabbit in the elite over 100 million category. The film franchise is the longest series in history. They say half the world's population has seen a Bond film. James Bond has affected the world in astonishing ways, not just in the ways the films and books have influenced what came afterwards, and not just in the action novel from Dick Francis to Jack Reacher, and the look and the sound of films, but in the actual world too, the film's designs having definite effects on modernist architecture, for example. But most fundamentally, how they changed, unlike all the others I can think of, how they changed the way that several generations have seen and felt the world. Perhaps most of all, by no means exclusively, for generations of British men who, after Bond, would never be able to put on a suit, order fancy wine, check into a foreign hotel, drive recklessly, try to have sex with someone, or go into a casino, without realising with shame and self-contempt how pathetically short our efforts in all these fields were falling below those of the master. To address the riddles of Bond and see how on earth it got that way, we've gathered some of the great Bond intellects in our deceptively homely undersea lair beside Westminster Abbey, where they are about to undergo some more rigorous questioning than they were anticipating. First, we have Simon Winder, a publishing director at Penguin Books, who's the author of brilliant books on Central European history, Germania, Danubia, Lotharingia. More importantly, his mad 2006 book, The Man Who Saved Britain, which somehow managed to combine the most hilariously jaundiced view of Bond with a kind of sick, slavish devotion to the entire phenomenon. I think that's fair, Simon?
Absolutely fair. Yeah.
And Professor James Chapman. James is professor at film studies at the University of Leicester, has written the definitive guide to the Bond films, License to Thrill, a cultural history of the James Bond films, first published in 1999 and subsequently updated to include the Daniel Craig era. And of course, our in-house Bond girl, Lucy Lethbridge, critic and author of fabulous social history tourists, How the British Went Abroad to Find Themselves. Lucy, did you consider Bond's impact on every single British person who's been abroad since the Second World War? Or was it outside your purview?
I didn't consider it, but I think it's quite interesting to look at that. There's the sort of advent of the villa holiday in Mallorca, the kind of expat Alan Wickery aspect of the 1960s and 70s, I think owes quite a lot to Bond. It's a kind of world of leisure, golf courses, martinis rather too early in the evening. And I think that is very much part of the sort of post-war experience of abroad for a lot of middle-class English.
Do you think Wicker got the idea of doing his thing from Bond? I mean, here was Bond going, doing a kind of Wickerish thing and then blowing it up, going to some lovely part of the world and then exploding it. And Wicker would do the same and then not blow it up.
Yes, or sort of impose his Englishness on it, isn't it? And he goes there with his little sort of cravat and he's very British. He sees it through this prism of correct, the correct drink, the shaken not stirred, the good suit, all the elements of Bond, as it were, that sort of travel the world and yet remain the same.
And without Bond's, kind of moral view of the world, I mean, his rather Manichaean view of the world that Bond has, perhaps. Maybe that's what lacks in Wicca. I don't know. What do you think?
I don't feel that Bond has any moral view of the world, but I'd be very interested to know what everyone else thinks about that. I think he's a moral vacuum.
It's an interesting point. We're definitely going to address that. Don't worry. I'm your host, Robert Thickness. This is Critical Mash, gateway to consciousness-expanding conversations about the things that might make life worth living, even if the world cries out for Bond to save us from a very obvious mega-villain across the Atlantic, demolishing the world economic system in an improbable and experimentalist way. Now, okay, right, so obviously the films have been much more influential than the books, but we must start with the books, go back to the beginning. And so, Simon, I'm going to turn to you. I think you were responsible for getting the paperbacks reprinted 20-odd years ago, was that?
Yes, that's right, yes. I've been working at Penguin for years, and I run the Penguin Modern Classics and Penguin Classics series for years. And one of my dreams when not doing Italian translations and things was to sneak in all the Ian Fleming novels. And as part of the process of doing that, I had to read them all again, for which I was paid incredibly. So, they were just as enjoyable as I remember them being.
I mean, but it was a bit of a gamble to reprint them, right? Because they had fallen out of... I mean, nobody was reading them.
Yes, I think they needed... I think they... Obviously, the Pan editions had sold many millions of copies for many years, and I think they'd just fallen on hard times because they were just old books. Say, John Buchan was just an old book, you know. But if once you turn them into a classic, then suddenly you have a different discussion. One, are they classics? You know, what is the definition of a classic? You know, is it... You know, it's a different kind of a classic from James Joyce. But there's an interesting conversation. Enough time had gone past since the books had come out that they can be seen as more like artifacts than if you were buying the new Geoffrey Archer or whatever. You know, there's interesting things to be said just because time had gone by. But also, I think Fleming was a really interesting... he was a super interesting bloke and a very interesting writer. And they're much better books in many ways, certainly the first five or six, than almost anything else in the whole genre. So...
obviously, you're also... Because that was about the time of the Daniel Craig reboot and Casino Royale. Or was it, absolutely coincidental with that? So that would have helped.
Yes, absolutely. I suppose what's odd is the way it was a sort of abusive relationship with Roger Moore or with Pierce Brosnan. You know, it's you would go to see the new one. It would be terrible. You would come out and say, never again. And then... 18 months or 2 years.
Never say never
back.
Again.
Yeah, never, 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 never say never again. And you go back in and it's the same old rubbish. And then along comes Casino Royale and it's pretty good, you know.
James, would you agree with that kind of characterization of the how it's gone?
Well, Never Say Never Again was Sean Connery, of course.
Yes.
No, I wouldn't. Roger Moore films are classics and brilliant.
Classics, because as Simon said, there are different.
And that's another definition of another definition of classic. There's an interesting difference between the way in which Bond has been positioned culturally in Britain, where he's seen, I think, as an heir to that John Buchan, Sapper, Bulldog Drummond tradition of gentlemen heroes. But when the books were first published in America and when they were republished in the in the US Pan editions, there's an association with pulp fiction, with the private eye genre. Yeah, and it's very interesting that Fleming, once when he was interviewed, and so they're saying, you enjoyed reading Bulldog Drummond when you were at school. And he said, yeah, but those archetypes are out of date now. I was striving for the style of people like... He mentioned Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler. In fact, Fleming had a correspondence with Raymond Chandler. They struck up quite a friendship.
And Chandler was a big fan of... Oh, they were mutual fans, I think. I mean, the thing is, the question is... Right, so obviously the American tradition would have been Hammer and so, and the English one would have been The Saint. But you wouldn't think of, republishing The Saint books.
No, I mean, I've been reading a ton of detective or thrillers for the past, 5 or 6 years, looking for new thrillers to publish, because obviously there's a ton which is out of print. And almost all of them, they're out of print for a very good reason. I mean, they're just absolutely, genuinely terrible. And I kept hoping, well, maybe if you go back far enough to, say, the 50s, you'd have an interesting prose style, which might have matured in interest. But it's not true on the whole. They're just terrible, terrible books.
Okay. I mean, there's Eric Ambler, who is...
Ambler's a marvel. Right, yeah, he's a great writer.
I mean, Fleming owes quite a lot to that thing. But then, I mean, The Saint went up to, the 60s or something.
The Saint was always rubbish, though, I think it's probably fair to say. I don't think... Charterists ever claimed to be anything other than a hack. And whereas I think Fleming had, came from a very interesting literary background. His brother was Peter Fleming, who's, you know, a remarkable writer. He was very friendly with a lot of other serious writers in one way or another, and all of whom somewhat patronised him. They all felt that James Bond was a bit, you know, people like Noel Coward view James Bond as being kind of rather sort of garbagey. But that was in many ways a class thing and to do with, like, you know, the way that I suppose Fleming accidentally hit the zeitgeist in a way which he didn't really intend. You know, like, he was right there were very personal books in a way because of his role as an intelligence during the Second World War, and just his own ennui. You know, that I think he wrote the first couple of books because he was just bored. You know, it was
anxious about his wife or something like that.
Yes, I mean, he was a kind of miserable kind of character. You know, and he was able to buck himself up by writing these books.
And so he was getting married to this scary woman, Anne Rothermere, and this is some way of sublimating. I haven't quite understood.
But also, I think he was so bottled up because he wasn't allowed to talk about all his work in the Admiralty during the Second World War. I mean, it was all secret, and he'd signed all kinds of, so the way that he could write about these things in a fictional form allowed him to say, you know, that obviously he couldn't blab. You know, he did all kinds of interesting things during the Second World War, but he was, from the outside point of view, those things weren't interesting because all the operations we now know about were in that period completely under wraps. Which again is curious to think of, this kind of idea of this sort of, well, it was a quite brutally enforced code in many ways, but that no one would dream of talking about what they did in the Second World War, and therefore the picture people had of the Second World War was drastically different from the one that we now have, which isn't to say our view of it is more accurate, but it's definitely more complete. Right. And things like Operation Mincemeat and things, you know, these came out in the 50s, bit by bit. There's a marvellous story, the trouble is with Fleming, there's a marvellous one I was reading about how, because he was in charge of all these special operations, that he one time employed people like Aleister Crowley and the occult people, and he got a bunch of Canadian soldiers who were dressed up as druids, and they hang out in the New Forest and did these incantations in order to get Rudolf Hess over.
And it worked, of course.
What can I say? You know? But I love the idea of bored Canadian troops dress up in these sort of, like, occult costumes.
Were they bringing, like, KKK stuff?
Absolutely. And going, and saying, you know, sacred words and things like that. And these waves.
And Crowley was there. And Crowley was there?
Crowley, I think, was an advisor. I don't know if he was
He didn't really have to be there in person. He could project himself.
But, I mean, like, it's this sort of nonsense where you never know if it's true. I mean, probably it's not true at all. None of it's true.
I mean,
obviously, the idea that the Nazis actually received these messages is patently insane.
But the Nazis love that stuff as well.
They would have liked if they had known what was going on in New Forest.
I mean, I'm amazed the Nazis didn't do the, you know, kind of reverse thing and kidnap Aleister Crowley and take him to Germany. I mean, then, you know, and use him, although he was a bit knackered by that point, I guess.
I think they probably thought he was a useful weapon in terms of reducing British morale at that point.
I was reading something about that and the suggestion that Bond then used Crowley as a model for, you know, one of it, because Crowley was, like, terribly fat and kind of sordid looking by this point. And so, you know, could have been the model for, I don't know, Drax or someone.
Blofeld, right. Aleister Crowley figure.
But then, I mean, then showing a great deal of discipline on Fleming's part not to introduce kind of supernatural devil-worshipping elements, when you think about it. I mean, this is extraordinary. Why didn't he do that?
Well, he has the familiar, doesn't he?
Right?
He has the cat familiar. Yeah. I mean, that's a kind of familiar trope, isn't it?
I mean, this is where we're going. I mean, this is actually quite disturbing now, because at some point I'm going to get onto the idea of Bond as in the kind of Tammuz god-like tradition, demiurge, psychopomp tradition of, immortal and constantly dying and coming back to life, but also basically redeeming us. But we'll come on to that. And I mean, if we can position this as actually a total religious Manichaean experience with with Blofeld as the devil with his... We'll move on to that at some point. People were very rude about the books, apart from the fan club of, you know, Kingsley Amis and Raymond Chandler and, I don't know, Anthony Burgess and so. Lots of people were terribly rude about the books. I mean, you said there was some kind of class element in that. What was that?
Well, I suppose it was the exact opposite of the whole world of, you know, David Story, Barry Hines, Margaret Drabble, you know, the idea of a writers writing about ordinary lives in the present. And then Fleming, I think, was writing these sort of, you know, these crazy fantasies. You know, it's just a very different environment, really. I mean, that he must have been way out of... In the 50s, I think, they were just loved by a lot of people. And then as they progressed, it became more and more unlikely that anyone would want to read them.
And it's a sort of fantasy version of masculinity, isn't it? In which women miraculously don't complain when you offer no commitment whatsoever, and, you know, but at the same time always available, that you always look fabulous in your beautiful suit, you know exactly where to go, all that, what you call that strange fussiness that he has about knowing all the right brands.
It's the right strawberry jam, I guess. Yes. That's a real low point of one of the books.
It's real sort of product placement, isn't it?
But, I mean, I think, you know, you're kind of overlaying the film Bond onto the book Bond a bit. I mean, in the books, I mean, he's not exactly a swooning romantic. But he does have his, you know, he has his moments. And so, you know, Tiffany, he has this very strong relationship with, for example, Tiffany Case, who then, it turns out, leaves him. I mean, they spend several months together after the end of the book. And eventually she gets sick of him and then moves on to a marine or something.
Well, that's convenient for him, isn't it?
Very convenient, Mr. Bond. Yes, I mean, you can't have it both ways, you know. I mean, he's heartbroken, as he is, like when Tracy gets killed. There's one who just kind of vanishes, which is the Russian girl, Tatiana Romanova, who, I mean, it's like they're going to have a long romance, and then she's never mentioned again after he dumps her in France. But that's, you know, maybe he has amnesia after all his trouble. But no, he's quite a romantic figure. And as Kingsley Amis again says, he's clearly descended from the Byronic hero. In the sense that a loner, kind of introspective, gloomy. There's elements of kind of Manfred and Childe Harold in there. And Tatiana Romanova compares him to, as I'm sure you remember, to Pechorin in A Hero of Our Time by Lermontov. And who was the kind of second Byronic hero in Russia after Onegin. And I think this tells us a great deal about him, not just in the way he looks, but in his kind of his gloom, which is reflected in the atmosphere of the books, right? I mean, they have this melancholy, and I forget which of the heroes, of the villains it is, that talks about Axidia and Anomie and all these kind of things. But the melancholy and the Axidia are actually inherent in the books as well.
Yes, they're very gloomy. I mean, and very. But in that sense, they are very 1950s. I mean, it's a very difficult time. One of the things that's so attractive about the books and the films is the way they obviously accidentally preserve in amber the period when they were made in a way which obviously at the time is invisible, but then becomes ever more visible with passing time. And in some ways they mature, in other ways they become totally unacceptable. As part of my research for today, I was watching Goldfinger again yesterday.
That kind of research, yes.
And it's still just a wonderfully enjoyable film. But I was surprised to realise that actually in time it's closer to Charlie Chaplin's first movie than it is to us. It was made an incredibly long time ago.
And Goldfinger just isn't very frightening in the film now, I think, is he? He just seems like a sort of podgy, you know...
A bit
podgy bad golfer.
Yes.
Well, cheating golfer, yes. He doesn't have to be because he's got Oddjob who will do the frightening things for him. I mean, an Oddjob is... Yeah. He can delegate the being frightening to Oddjob, as presumably Christopher Lee can to... Knick-knack.
Yes, that's a disaster.
Well, that's the other way around. I mean, Christopher Lee has presence.
You're right. Knick-knack. Well,
although Knick-knack was a remarkable... This was Hervé Villechaize. who is a remarkable character in so many ways, but we must get on. But you're right, actually. I mean, Christopher Lee, who didn't have to really, I mean, who could just have phoned in that performance, but he actually managed to be Christopher Lee in that terrible film.
He's also trying to break away from Count Dracula at the time. It's a year after The Wicker Man. And, you know, Lee's wanting to do better films than horror movies. I'd like to pick up on some of these points about Fleming. When you actually look into it in some detail, the reception of Fleming at the time was quite fascinating. We tend to, I think Paul Johnson's review of Dr. No, which he headed Sex, Snobbery and Sadism, and is an absolute scathing review of all the worst qualities in Fleming's writing.
Kind of review that all critics love to write, by the way.
Conditioned our view, and you know, we think that's how Fleming was received. It's not, actually. Casino Royale had very good reviews from the sort of quality literary press, TLS, Times, and so on. And it was seen as being a sort of superior thriller with a sort of sophisticated villain. That's where Fleming's those brand names come in, that kind of snob value. But it was also, I think, an indicator of a degree of authenticity. You can believe in the fantastical plots if you know what your hero had for breakfast, if you know what you know brands he likes to wear and so on. And Fleming was very good at that kind of detail. Casino Royale is actually quite a, you know, I think it's more in the kind of Eric Ambler tradition of a thriller. It's a plausible Cold War story. We've not yet got into the sensationalism, the megalomaniacs. That comes in Live and Let Die, it comes in the second novel. The ones in between are the sensational, you know, megalomaniacs intent on, you know, robbing Fort Knox and hijacking atom bombs and dropping an atomic rocket.
Yeah, I mean, he got into his stride. I mean, all, you know, they're sort of different, right? I mean, Casino Royale has this kind of gloomy realism about it, although the premise is obviously crazy.
But it's also got a really bleak ending. Yeah. You know, Bond is betrayed by the girl, Vesper. Always described as the girl. He's betrayed. She turns out to have been a Soviet agent. And the last line, you know, the bitch is dead now. Mm. It's really bitter at the end of that. And I think that does, you know, if we, you know, Bond is a fictional construct, he's not a real person, but if we attribute him to him the kind of, you know, emotional and psychological makeup of a real person, then the, I won't say misogyny, but certainly I think the questionable attitude towards women, which we see throughout some of the other stories, might be explained by that moment of betrayal. The women in the Bond books are fascinating, way more interesting in view than the films, or at least the early films. Bond is quite a chivalrous character, although he's a modern character in his sort of sexual appetites and so on. He's very protective towards women. There's a sense of wanting to protect them, and that's, I think, conditioned by Fleming's, you know, background, his class background, and so on. What the books do quite interestingly on occasion is subvert that by putting Bond in a position where the girl has to rescue him. Mm-hmm. And in most of the stories, there's a scene where the girl saves Bond's life. So it's Solitaire who manages to help him escape from Mr. Big in Harlem, in Live and Let Die. Tiffany turns up on the handcart on the railway to get him away from the
everyone's favourite bit of
a peculiarly ludicrous,
bizarre scene in Diamonds Are Forever. Honey Rider is perfectly capable. I mean, Dr. No's devised this imaginative death for her. Bond's, I've got to get out onto the rocks. No, she rescues herself, comes in, and she's going to kill Dr. No with a screwdriver.
It's also a very interesting thing, is because that Fleming kind of subverts the kind of lascivious sadism anticipation of the reader. When we hear that Honey Rider is going to be eaten alive, she's staked out naked, going to be eaten by these crabs. And she said, no, they were very friendly. I was basically on first name terms with most of these crabs anyway. And it was all absolutely fine. They just walked over me and did their bit. And so the reader's like really hoping to do something, and Fleming pulls out the carpet from under your feet.
Story about the making of Dr. No, where they attempted to do the crab scene, and it's in the production reports. There's a day in which you can find it, the day which it shot at Pinewood towards the end of the shoot, and it didn't work. One story is that the crabs sort of died of cold. The others is they showed a disinclination to want to call over Ursula Andress, as unbelievable as that is. And they just look visible.
So Bond, the character, and of course is I mean, everyone makes the point that he's a completely blank and uninteresting character. And I kind of get on my high horse and say, well, no woman could possibly be interested in him because, you know, he's really got nothing to say at all. And then my wife says, you know, but he's actually got terrific sex appeal. So actually women would be interested in him. And he doesn't have to say anything. He just has to stand there in his blasted suit. It's fine. Okay, I'm going to get weird.
But isn't that the nature of the Byronic seducer as well, isn't it? Because, I mean, you know, Don Giovanni doesn't have very much conversation either, does he?
No, he's just
like a sort of motor force.
Nice singing voice.
Yes.
No, you're right. I mean, and this is, you know, but obviously most normal men are very resentful of this characteristic, and while recognising that it does exist, but we kind of wish it didn't, or we wish that it was us, which it isn't on the whole.
Also, it's that 1950s world, isn't it, of sex being a much more like serious thing to do with potential pregnancy and things like that. You know, the range of contraceptives is much more limited. It's a world not of monogamy, but of, you know, an affair is a major thing. You know, the cultural world of the 50s is really very drastically different from what it would be even say 10 years later. And so again, what's interesting to me is like the way that the Bond books are actually very constrained. You know, he is quite chivalrous. There aren't a lot of girls around. He lives a strange life, which would the original readership would have found very exotic. But then, for the original readership, going to Calais would be exotic. You know, it's so there's it's a very different world of currency controls.
I think this point about Fleming's work sort of reflecting sort of social historical conditions of post-war Britain is an important one. The Casino Royale is published right at the tail end of the years of austerity. You know, it's been just coming out of that sort of post-war regime, and I think Bond's brand names, you know, his Tiptree Strawberry Jam and his Rolex and so on, have that kind of a sort of cultural resonance at the time. When, you know, some consumer goods luxury items are still a little bit scarce compared to today, when these items are in supermarkets. So the books then, when they start to take off, I mean, the early sales were quite modest, but from round about 57, 58, you start to see quite exponential increases in the sales. One, it's but the back catalogue is selling. Two, they're going into paperback. But Bond is gaining momentum. That's when film producers are starting to look at them and get interested in them. By that time, even in those, so you say 5 years from say 1953 to 1958, you society has changed quite considerably. Fleming by that time is writing alongside the emergence of the new wave cinema, the Northern Realists. It's the first stirrings of that cultural revolution that we see. Depending on your view, either starts with John Osborne and Look Back in Anger in 1956, or Philip Larkin says it starts in 1963. There's a lovely reference, I think, in Kenneth Williams' diaries that about the swinging 60s. And there is a view that the 60s didn't swing very much outside of West London. And he talks about riding around on his moped, looking for where all the swinging parties were and always being too late for them.
The 60s is filled with early middle-aged Second World War veterans who view all these screaming girls and things with the Beatles as just being sort of like, it's just a sort of sad joke rather than... And I think there's an interesting book to be written about the other cultures of that period, of people listening to you know, late night on Radio 2 or whatever, where you would have people phoning in and singing songs over the phone. I remember an old lady singing, if I knew you were coming, I would have baked a cake over her phone line on this late night. Or there were just, these were crooner groups and things like that. And that was the 60s and 70s as well, you know. Yes. And so it's, so Fleming is oddly divorced from all this because, you know, he's very posh. He's living in Jamaica as much as he can.
And quite old.
And quite old, yeah. And I think he's kind of baffled, you know.
It's quite interesting, though, isn't it, that the films, I don't know how, if they were always positioned as family films, but by the end of the 60s, they are positioned completely as family entertainment. And that's why, you know, we remembered in our youth going to The Man with the Golden Gun.
Yeah. Yes, because they kept the certificate down.
A certificate.
Nowadays, yeah, it'd be adorned with trigger warnings, wouldn't it? And worrying attitudes that would have to be explained later and all that kind of thing.
We need to get on to the villains, which is like a massive invention or perfection of something that Fleming did. I mean, and what are the antecedents? The people like Fu Manchu and so forth.
Fu Manchu, definitely. I mean, like those books are really worth reading. I mean, they're staggeringly offensive, but they are also incredibly enjoyable. You know, I mean, the Sax Rohmer was a remarkable writer, and it is funny how a lot of things associated with Fleming are actually Sax Rohmer and other lesser writers from that period. I remember there's a marvellous bit where the police think they're about to capture Fu Manchu in the East End, but they go through this room and they turn on the light, and the light activates these poisonous mushrooms that kills them all, kind of thing, with their spores or whatever. And Fu Manchu just laughs and runs off, having killed all the police, kind of thing. And is that so? In the 1920s, this stuff was being done. You know, bulldog.
Does he get good speeches, Fu?
Oh, terrific! Yeah, absolutely terrific. He's always got some, you know, I shall conquer you all, kind of thing. You know, there's always another master plan. You know, so there are a lot of fun earlier antecedents as well.
I mean, but this is it reaches perfection in Dr. No and Goldfinger, who get to kind of expound the aesthetics of violence, all these things that they get to.
Well, Fleming invents this motif, and it's there. It probably is there it's there to a degree in Sapper. It's there in Sax Rohmer, but Fleming perfects this idea that any world class supervillain, when he has the hero captive, round about the two-thirds, three-quarter way into the book, needs to, first of all, entertain him to a very sumptuous dinner whilst lecturing him on the nature of power and on different methods of torture, which he's then going to apply to Bond. And we see that...
make him lose his appetite. It's amazing.
We see that in Dr. No. We see it in
are you going to want those carrots? They're monologuing so much.
The dinner sequence in Doctor No, where Bond says, "Oh, the glint in his eye," and so, but Bond's trying to get Doctor No to talk about his megalomania while he's trying to lift a knife off the table to hide. Yeah. The Fleming villains, they're caricatures, but they're also, I think, representing a particular, you know, ideological framework. There's a clear shift from the books written during the 50s, with the one exception, and that's Diamonds Are Forever, which pits Bond against American gangsters. But in the 50s, the villain is either directly or indirectly an agent of the Soviet Union. He's either a member of SMERSH or he's a kind of freelance, like Dr. O, he's a kind of freelance contractor for the Soviet Union. So in the background, we have the Cold War. The Cold War is still there in the background. These books were written at the height of Cold War tensions and so on. In the early 60s, from Thunderball onwards, Soviet villainy doesn't entirely disappear. There are still references, but by and large, we're moving to the spectre years, where Fleming, or depending on which version of the origin of Thunderball you want to believe, Kevin McClory and Jack Whittingham, create this international diabolical organisation, the Special Executive for Counterintelligence, Terrorism, Revenge and Extortion, which is supposed to be completely non-ideological. It's against left and right. It's just there for to you know, steal nuclear weapons and hold powers to ransom. And that's a shift that is quite marked in the books. And it's interesting that when the films come along, that's the formula that the films adopt, and they retrospectively recast the Soviet villains of the earlier books into this Spectre framework.
Right, yeah. As parts of Spectre, yeah, good point. I mean, it required the Second World War to have these kind of villains, right? I mean, because like before the Soviet Union, so without Stalin and Hitler, you couldn't really have these guys going on about power in the way they did.
You get it across a lot of British popular culture. You get it in Dan Dare, Pilot of the Future, and Eagle with the Mekon. He was a sort of totalitarian, yeah, alien technocrat, and so on. You get it in Doctor Who, you know, Davos and Morbius and villains like that. But there's also, I think, it's something interesting geopolitically going on. Russia has always been a villain in British popular fiction, going back into the, you know, at least into the 19th century, a geopolitical threat. Communism just adds another ideological layer onto that. This is why spy fiction survived the end of the Cold War, because communism might end, but Russia still.
Yeah. Well, this is why I think there was a terrific kind of hole in our who to hate thing between about 1990 and 2010. You know, when we could recast Mr. Putin as Dr. Evil.
Germany also is a villain in, you know, pre-war spy invasion stories, the Riddle of the Sands, yeah, and so on. Nazism becomes public enemy number one, if you like, during the Second World War. And what post-war fiction does in a quite fascinating way is meld the threat of Germany and the threat of communism. Mm. So Fleming does it in Moonraker. Drax is acting on behalf of the Soviet Union,
but he's
a fanatical ex-Nazi, yeah, with a hatred of Britain. So you merge the legacy of the Second World War and the Cold War. And we tend to see Fleming as being very different from the kind of more realist tradition of fiction that someone like John le Carré represents. But go back to Spy Who Came In From the Cold, and where's the villain in Spy Who Came In From the Cold? It's East Germany. Yeah. So again, the old enemies merged. You know, communism overlaid onto the threat of Germany, and that's something that works through, you know, both the Fleming sensationalist type of literature and the Le Carré psychologically realist type of literature. They share the same kind of ideological framework, even though in style they're very different.
Do you think also that, I mean, it occurred to me, and this is in the films, I feel is that one of the enemies of Bond is modernity itself. Because the villains in Bond films are always, all the sort of aesthetics of evil are kind of brutalist, aren't they? Brutalist architectures, kind of hideous machinery and natural landscapes that hide, you know, under which kind of enormous underground car parks are hidden and so on. And Bond himself, with his Tiptree jam and his slightly Heath Robinson, you know, gadgets, his gadgetry, is a kind of gentleman amateur. And an indirect contrast to this rather sort of hideous, kind of technical, frightening universe.
But Bond and modernity, I think it works in different ways between the books and the films. In the books, Bond is quite old-fashioned. He drives a 1930s Bentley. He has a nostalgic attachment to the old £5 note and regrets its demise and so on. And there are all these sort of instances of a kind of, I suppose, cultural conservatism that comes through. In the films, he becomes an agent of modernity. The films dump the Bentley. Bond embraces the modern. And it's because of his command, his ownership of technology, that he's able to combat these highly technological
But Lucy has a point that I mean, he finds himself in these dystopian. I mean, this is, we need to get onto the question of, you know, Ken Adam's designs of this amazing brutalist world. Christopher Frayling said that Ken Adam was born in Germany in 1920 something, and they had to emigrate in the early 30s for the usual reasons. And Christopher Frayling, the film historian, says that without that kind of upbringing, Ken Adam would never have produced these basically things based on the Führer bunker, which is where all the villains live, and which influence architecture going for. I mean, the Norman Foster building seemed to be entirely based on designs in Bond films, frankly. And I think he admitted it himself at some point. He said, you know, these were all architectural fantasies which Ken Adam built, and then, you know, basically I put them in, built them in at Pinewood, and then I built them in real life at the Gherkin. Anyway, but Bond finds himself in these Bonds, you know, the maybe not the amateur, but the professional, but the kind of gentleman of the fairly gentlemanly chap of the 1950s, finds himself in the 60s, finds himself in these terrible spaces, terrible, threatening, brutalist spaces. And he is, but then us, he represents us in this awful situation, which he then has to overcome by pluck, ingenuity, and Britishness.
But curiously, I suppose that Ian Fleming himself, like his house in Jamaica, was very modern. You know, that was a modernist building as well. It's like, so he, I mean, I walked around it once, and it's just like a very, it's, you know, it's a big box, you know, and it's very Bauhaus in atmosphere. And again, you think it's a surprise. You'd expect him to be much more twiddly and olden times, but because like, his role in the war was definitely to do with technology, modernity, everything being like cutting edge. You know, like his whole life himself, he was very interested, very early adopter of the Aqualung, for example. I mean, I think it's really interesting that like his Jamaican, all the time he spends in Jamaica is actually very important to writing the books, not just because he writes them there, but because he, because the idea of these kind of holiday places is in itself new. And therefore, the technology around being there is also new. Underwater photography, you know, these things are all being pioneered in this period with Jacques Cousteau and so on. You know, so it's a really he's a funny old mix, because he's definitely, he's obsessed with new things because that's what allowed him to do his job in the Second World War. And personally, he's interested in new things, and yet at the same time, he's
a member of the old world.
Yeah, he regrets change. But in effect, his whole life and his rackety private life and so on is all very post-war, you know, and therefore it's not surprising his books are themselves this funny old mix of, you know, Eton and, you know, killing stacks of foreigners or whatever. You know.
Do you think it works to, I mean, just to think about Bond in the context of having a background like Ian Fleming, having a childhood and so on, do you think it works when they attempted with the Daniel Craig figure to give him some sort of hinterland? Because that always felt to me very awkwardly squeezed in.
He should
emerge from nothing, shouldn't he? He's like a...
I think all this sort of like feeling Daniel Craig's pain sort of thing is like fast forward, isn't it? You
know? Yeah.
Well, this is like the fashionable self-pity of today's youth, if I may say so. I mean, it's all about their feelings, right?
It's also the Christopher Nolan Batman effect. Right. Bruce Wayne's got to explore his childhood psychosis and so on. I love reading the books when I'm travelling. And the chapter where Bond travels to the overseas destination is because Fleming's very good on the sights and the sounds, the smells of places, you know, the kind of texture. He was a brilliant travel writer. As a writer of action sequences and fights and so on, it's rather perfunctory.
Well, and often kind of gives up. I mean, the end of in Goldfinger, when he's. He's tailing Goldfinger across France, and there's this very loving description of, and then it's, oh, he knew a little place in, you know, in Orléans where he could have lunch, you know, down by the river, and all that, and it goes on, and it's brilliant, and it goes on and on and on, as he's driving, I mean, it feels rather leisurely, but he's actually zooming across France, and then if you compare that to the Battle at Fort Knox, I mean, it deals with that in about five pages.
I was going to say three pages. Yeah. It's over, yeah.
It's like, who cares? It's over. I mean, I realise this is ridiculous. I'm not even going to bother with it, the things that he loved. We should get on to the kind of the psychological effect of Bond, which is probably for our generation, obviously more to do with the films. Simon encapsulated it rather well in that book of his. He says, around the world, an entire generation of young men were damaged by nude silhouettes of girls licking guns, being shot with harpoons and so on. Which I was thinking, okay, but I mean, it's better than Andrew Tate. I mean, thank God, you know, we were damaged. And this is a very shorthand for what happened. But the thing, as I said at the beginning, Englishmen of our generation can't check into a foreign hotel or put on a dinner jacket without walking across
a lobby. I'm sometimes immobilised by how difficult it is to walk across a lobby. Am I looking notably prattish as I do this? Or are people saying, ooh, look, what a hungry look he has.
As you stalk like a panther.
Right? Pantherine kind of suiting.
No one ever talks about this, but this is actually, and I think it was true of my father's generation as well, that they, from the moment they read Casino Royale and so forth, and how has it possessed us in a way that...
Yes, there's no machine which measures the, I guess...
Die Hard. We don't, you know, when we're in a lift, we don't think of Die Hard.
No, not a role model.
Bloodstained vest, you know. No.
But there must be some satellite that could tell over the years how many women... I guess millions must have gone at various points, oh God, you know, when whoever they're going out with behaves in a very slightly Bondy way, you know, like I'll have a martini or whatever. And it's like, oh no.
Well, I think that's why, being perhaps not quite such a diehard, a Bond fan to the extent that you lot are, I find there's something rather sort of touching about the male Bond fanaticism. There's something sweet. He holds up a fantasy that's almost completely unfulfillable. And he is, I think, less attractive to women than you probably imagine he is.
No, I have, my straw poll reveals that all women I've asked want to be his girlfriend. And, obviously there's kind of sex aspect, but there's also flying cars, you know. I mean, come on. Getting killed, maybe worth it, you know. I mean, here's another thing. I mean, obviously, because he is the homme fatale of which we spoke.
If you wanted a flying car, you could have Caractacus Potts in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, also written by Fleming. No. And you know, he'd probably stay around.
He hasn't been inside your head for these years. I see, but you're quite rare in that sense.
No.
I
mean, Pierce Brosnan got quite far in.
Moving on from that.
Yeah, the later Roger Moores, the inner nurse carer would come out as you're going to help him across the lobby.
Yes, watch your heart, Rog.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like, well, are you sure you should be having pudding? You know.
I'm interested in where the films themselves came from. I mean, when Dr. No turns up in 1962, there's no obvious kind of British tradition that would give birth to this kind of thing.
It's a B movie tradition, mm. and it's maybe a radio tradition as well. So Dick Barton, Special Agent, late 40s, early 50s, which there were some low budget films that were made of that. But the thriller or the sensational action thriller as a genre was something for the lowbrow supporting end of the market. In 1959, Hitchcock's film North by Northwest was released. This is a feature, glossy production values, and has sometimes been seen as a sort of progenitor of the James Bond movies. We know that Fleming saw it. He even there's a reference to the film in the novel of Thunderball. What the Bond films do, and where I think they are historically really important, regardless of their quality as films, is that they took what was essentially B-movie material and made it with A-feature production values. Dr. No had a budget of, it was about £320,000. Not huge, but it was not a low budget film. It was at the top end of the middle third for a British feature film in 1962. And it went over budget by quite a bit, largely because of the sets. But what then Brocklin Saltzman, could be Brocklin Harry Saltzman, the producers did, was persuade United Artists to say, double the budget for the next film. Now, usually with a sequel, you assume the sequel is going to take maybe 30% less at the box office, so you reduce the budget. That was the standard model for sequels before the Bond movies. But no, they upped the budget for Mission Impossible. It's about £70,000. Goldfinger, £1 million. Thunderball, £2 million. The budgets go up. The production values become that much more spectacular and so on. And of course, the success of the films really takes off. Thunderball is easily within the top 10 films at the box office in the 1960s. Goldfinger is in the top 20. So Bond becomes this kind of box office juggernaut. And the formula is based on high production values, on putting those values on the screen. So you have the locations, you have the sets, you have the vehicles, real vehicles being trashed, not models, but and so on. You go out to the film of Dr. No, and you watch Dr. No. It starts off as basic kind of police procedural thriller. Bond is sent to Jamaica to investigate the disappearance of the British agent there. It looks good, it's sun-drenched Technicolor, but there's nothing particularly special about the film for the first 40 minutes or so. Then we have a scene where Professor Dent gets the boat, goes out to Dr. No's island, and so on. There's a location shot of him sort of getting off the boat, and then we cut and we go into a studio sequence, and at this moment, the nature of British cinema changes forever, because he walks into that Ken Adam, I'll call it the Caligari room, where basically it's just it's room, it's shadow. There's one light source, and it's the tarantula in the cage, and Dent has to go and pick it up. It's entirely expressionist. The film, the look of the film, the visual style changes at that moment. We go from this sort of realistic procedural format into this fantasy thriller world.
But also it's cheap, which is also interesting. It's like it's a wonderfully, the minimalism is partly because of the budget as well. I mean, Adam, when he got a bigger budget, did more dramatic things, but it's cool because it cost almost nothing to make.
It's at that moment that you're entering to a different kind of thriller. The film is clearly not going to be Room at the Top or Saturday Night and Sunday Morning. It's not going to be a social realist film. Interesting, the set that caused the problems was Dr. No's dining room and so on, which is quite sumptuous, but it was that set and the reactor room went quite a way over budget, and that's what caused your Dr. No's quite a high overcost actually, but it got it back at the box office easily.
I kind of feel that we're going to have to do a second one of these, going through the films, because we haven't got enough time to do the films justice. But they've been through the several kind of cycles of overinflation and then going back to basics.
Well, it comes back in 1995 with GoldenEye, which brilliantly has that scene with Judi Dench and the new M. M becomes a woman, and the film addresses all these criticisms of Bond by keeping Bond pretty much as Bond, but then allowing other characters around him to voice, and what does Judi Dench say? You're a sexist, misogynist dinosaur, a relic of the Cold War, and so on. And the film itself engages with that idea of Bond being out of date. GoldenEye does very well at the box office.
How do we feel about the future? I mean, now he's been killed off. I mean, we've established that he's immortal or constantly returning to life, a la Tammuz and so forth. But, I mean, what happens now?
They'll do what in the fashionable terms is called a reboot. You just forget the previous continuity and start all over.
Could be
again.
Like JR. Could be a dream, the last one or something.
No, that's no. Because that would have to maintain continuity with the Bond films have done it before. In what the term wasn't being used at the time. It's what we would now call a soft reboot. So George Lazenby was a one-off James Bond in On Her Majesty's Secret Service, which, although he gets a bad rap from a lot of critics, I think he's okay. He's not Sean Connery, but he's good in the action sequences. That film is a masterpiece of an action movie. It's the closest to Fleming's book. It pretty much maintains the structure of the book. The action sequences have got some real bite and intensity in them, and it maintains the ending. Bond's wife is killed, and he's there, you're cradling, you're dying of it, dead. He's crazy. Now, the idea was that they were going to then follow up in the next film. They'd already decided it was going to be Diamonds Are Forever, but it was basically going to be a revenge narrative. Bond and Draco, Tracy's father, were going to track down Blofeld and see to him. At some point, Lazenby is out of the project. It's various stories around this. Was he pushed? Did he walk? It ultimately doesn't really matter. United Artists negotiated a deal with Sean Connery, which brought him back for one film. Bocca and Saltzman, I think, weren't all that keen. But Connery got this extraordinary financial compensation to come back for the one film. And once he was back, if you look at Diamonds Are Forever, there is no reference to Bond at the end of the previous film having suffered trauma, his wife being killed, and so on. It moves on. They drop the Majesty. It's almost as if Majesty's never happened.
And the same with Casino Royale, yeah. I guess.
The Bond films have done that kind of soft reboot. With Casino Royale, I think it's clearer because we see Bond being assigned his 007 status. Mm. So it's clearly at the start of his career. So this is a new Bond in a different continuity, which therefore makes no sense whatsoever in Skyfall when he's got the Goldfinger Aston Martin. You know, so and some people get really annoyed about that. It doesn't bother me in the slightest, but because I don't think these internal contradictions of the continuity matter.
It's a very confusing thing, isn't it? Yeah. Because it's like, you know, the real issue is when Judi Dench says, "Oh, you're a dinosaur." It's like almost literally true because he would have been born in about 1920, and it's you know that they should be discussing, you know, his pension requirements and things. In fact, you could have a marvelous James Bond where he's just been for 2 hours, he's being talked through by HR. What his options are and all the rest of it, and his like leisure home and his prostate problems and his, you know, and it's like it would just, the whole thing would just be, you know, mournful.
Maybe that's what they'll do now. Maybe that's what we'll have is, you know, a series like the Reggie Perrin or something. He'll be going to see Doc Morrissey for him to get signed off, and so that's a very good point. I mean, the thing is that it must, if it does. I mean, as Philip Larkin said, you know, that will be England gone. If Bond should not come back, and then
I feel he went ages ago though. I just think you know, the Connerys are great.
We will always have.
I think it's like it's been fairly consistently terrible ever since. You know, like they're just not very good films
in different ways.
Yes, I mean they take turns to do different things which are just sort of poor. You know, and. Yeah, I thought the whole period of Pierce Brosnan, for example. I mean, he's just like a ridiculously limited actor. You know, all he could do was...
So was Connery. I mean, it wasn't a problem, was it?
Yeah, but Connery, I guess, was fresh. Whereas I think the difficulty... I mean, I do think that probably the best thing to do is just watch Goldfinger repeatedly and not really bother with continuity.
You call it a gesamt Kunstwerk. I mean, I totally agree with you because obviously it's got... I mean, you know, the Wagnerian echoes. Clearly, it's all about gold, just like Wagner. So, I mean, it's a very good word for it. But you're right. So this is... I mean, I think this is what we should think about.
It's also the extent to which... I mean, it requires a certain element of knowingness, doesn't it, to play Bond? But too much knowingness kills it, yes. Which is what happened with...
They've tried. They've tried too much, too little.
So, but now it's almost impossible not to do it too much, I think, isn't it? I mean...
Yes, because like with Roger Moore, like, was it From a View to a Kill? Like, I felt at various points people should be offering him a chair. You know, it's like, you know, he'd be like, if he was walking through something, he'd be like, "Are you all right? You know, can I get you some a sort of tisane or something like that?" You know, blanket.
I'm glad we are coming on to Roger Moore, who is officially the finest James Bond actor.
You and Alan Partridge and believe that. I think that's...
That's because I say so. Roger Moore's films are seen as taking Bond into parody. Now, because there's no parody in Goldfinger or Thunderball whatsoever. There's always that kind of parodic element to it. But with the Roger Moore films, they start to play it up. His style is different. The one-liners, I think, take on a different kind of meaning. However, just as I would argue that License to Kill was the first Daniel Craig James Bond film, it just happened to have Timothy Dalton in it. So Diamonds Are
Not the Living Daylight.
So Diamonds Are Forever. Mm. Is the first Roger Moore film. It just happens to have Sean Connery in it. Because Connery's performance in Diamonds is different from all the previous films. It's camp, that is exactly the word. And he comes back, he's sending it up, he's getting knocked around by Bambi and Thumper. He's sort of swinging around the casinos in Las Vegas. He's walking to a casino, so immaculately attired, where everybody else is there in kind of, you know, shorts and jeans and so on. Charles Gray's marvellously camp Blofeld appearing in drag, point, yeah. You know, so let's not blame Roger Moore for the Bond films going into camp and parody. It was all going that way.
Chaps, we're going to have to wind this up, but it's been terrific. And I feel we need to kind of continue this discussion over lunch in another underground bunker. But thank you so much for coming. This has been amazing. Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.